of the advances in artificial intelligence and robotic technology, the implications for our understanding of what it means to be human. And this is a fast-developing world, and he's going to bring us up to speed with what's going on. Just to say, there will be John will speak for about 45 minutes to an hour, and then there will be a break for refreshments. And during refreshments, if you have a question that you want to ask, there are slips of paper on the table at the back and pens. Write your question down, put it in the box. And during the interval there, we will get those questions out, and John will have probably about half an hour for Q&A afterwards. So talk, refreshments, questions, question and answer back here, and hopefully we'll finish by about 9:30. John, it's really great to have you with us. We've been remarking over and over again today how rapidly the world is changing in so many ways. And I just thought I'd read one verse from the scriptures tonight, from the Christian scriptures, just to remember that in the midst of a rapidly changing world, we do have an anchor that holds us fast. Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you were brought forth, or you brought forth the whole world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Let's pray, and then I'll hand over to John. Let's pray together. Father, thank you that in the midst of this seemingly maelstrom of change all around us and the complexities of modern life, we thank you that we can come to you, the living God, firm, steadfast, unchanging, the same yesterday, today, and forever. Thank you that you are a rock, a refuge, a tower, a strong fortress. Thank you that you are our stability and our security in this world. But thank you too that you're not a God far away, that you're intimately involved in what's going on, and you want us as your people to be aware of what's going on and to be relating to this world and helping this world understand where it's come from and where it's going. And so we pray tonight that we implore you, we beg you, that through your servant you'd help us to understand better the world in which we're living, the advances in technology, the challenges, the opportunities, and also the dangers. And we thank you for John being with us. Thank you for all he's given us today as a church. Thank you that he's here to speak to a wider audience tonight, and we pray your hand will be upon him, that you'll sustain him. And at the end of this long day for him, give him real freshness as he tackles this subject. Father, I'm saying to you that I want to learn and grow and change. And may that be the prayer of all our hearts tonight, that we want to learn and grow and change. And be people who represent you appropriately in this world in which we live. So we commit John to you and this time to you now, in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Thank you, John.
Well, thanks very much, Tim. Thank you for this opportunity to speak about a really challenging topic, one that's rapidly changing. Apologies, my voice is a bit croaky, but I hope I'll be able to keep going. My background is as a baby doctor. I spent a long time, as some of you know, working in a big intensive care unit for babies in central London, and caring for tiny, some of them extremely premature babies. And the question is, what on earth is a baby doctor doing talking about AI and robotics? And it's a good question. But the reason I became interested in this area is really because as I became more and more interested in the ethical issues that are happening in medicine and seeing how medical technology is advancing, it repeatedly raises the question, what does it mean to be human? Each time technology advances, as we're more and more able to keep humans alive in different conditions, as we're able to investigate the way the brain works. Thanks very much. as we try and do these things, it asks the question, what does it mean to be human? And so I've been very interested in new forms of technology which are raising that question. And it seems to me artificial intelligence is raising that question again in a new way. At the moment, it's just starting, but I predict it's going to be something which is going to sweep through our culture. It's going to lead to all kinds of new and interesting and strange and unusual challenges. And I'm going to just illustrate where I see some of the challenges that are coming, and then also just some preliminary reflections from a Christian point of view. So historically, these three kinds of beings were always regarded as being entirely different from one another. So there were human beings like us, and we were unique on the planet. And then there were animals, non-human animals, who are our close relations, but fundamentally different from us. And then there were machines, the things that our hands made, the artifacts. And these three categories were always seen as really completely separate. But what's happening is that over the last decades, in fact, you can trace it going back probably 100 years, the boundaries between these categories is blurring. So what's the real difference between a human and an animal? Maybe, you know, as biology advances, we discover that, in fact, chimpanzees are extremely similar to us. In fact, the DNA is probably more than 98% of the DNA of a chimpanzee is the same as a human being. You look at this brain structure, very similar to us. And so is there really a difference between animals and humans? Are humans just primates with a bit of extra cerebral brain cortex? And then is there really, and this is where we'll be looking particularly today, is there a difference between the human and the machine? Or are we, for instance, as one robotics specialist said, just computers made out of meat? And is there really a difference between a computer made out of meat and a computer made out of silicon? So what's happening is that these boundaries are blurring, and it increasingly raises the question then, what does it mean to be human? Is there anything distinctive about being human? And that's a question we're going to come back to as we think about it. But I just want to go now and start talking about science fiction. If you really are interested in this topic and about the questions of artificial intelligence, it's actually science fiction that has been raising the questions long before they became a real something happening in the real world. And if you're interested in this topic and want to do some research, the place to start is science fiction. And one of the very significant writers is Isaac Asimov, and a whole series of novels called the Robot novels, or iRobot. And it was Asimov who came up with what he called the three laws of robotics. As you can see, this is taken from the Handbook of Robotics, 56th edition, 2058. So, and the three laws of robotics are, first of all, that a robot shouldn't injure a human being. Second, that a robot must obey the orders given to it by human beings, except where that would conflict with number one. And thirdly, a robot must protect itself as long as it doesn't predict conflict with number two and number one. And if you've read any of the novels of Asimov, you will know that a lot of the plot of the novels come out from all kinds of unexpected things that robots start doing because they're trying to follow these laws. And now, that was all science fiction, but lo and behold, this is now becoming reality, because as more and more autonomous systems are being developed, including autonomous vehicles, autonomous weapons, and so on, software engineers are trying to encode some kind of ethical code into these systems. Sadly, it turns out that Asimov's three laws don't work very well, and that you need something far more sophisticated to be able to cope with the complexities of what can happen in the real world. But this is an example where science fiction has started with something, science fiction writers just playing games, but it's now becoming deadly reality. How do you encode an ethical code? Having worked in the area of medical ethics and having seen all the controversies that go on about how on earth you develop ethical codes in medicine, and different philosophical approaches and so on. I have to say, I'm not very optimistic about how successful software engineers and manufacturers are going to be in creating ethical codes for machines. But nonetheless, it's a very big issue. Another very influential writer is Philip K. Dick, American writer writing in the post-war period. And it was he who came up with the idea of humanoid robots who were so close to human beings that you actually couldn't tell the difference. And he called them replicants. And the very famous film Blade Runner, the original film in 1982, is based on stories of Philip K. Dick and deals with replicants. And in a very clever twist, Philip K. Dick said that the replicants could be implanted with false memories so that the replicants could be given the false memories of a human being. And that meant that the replicant didn't realize it was a replicant, but thought it was human. And so the whole plots of the novels is you're never quite sure whether this is a human or a replicant who thinks it's a human or a human who thinks it's a replicant and so on. So very clever and at the moment still very much science fiction. There are humanoid robots and we're going to come to them. In fact, the main emphasis in robotics is not to create replicants who are very similar to human beings, but many other kinds of robots. Star Trek, again, an important source. And Commander Data, those of you who are Trekkies will know, Commander Data is a sophisticated robotic system, completely artificial, but who behaves as a person. And there's an episode of Star Trek where the manufacturers of Commander Data wish to pull him apart in order to work out how his robotic brain is working. But in the process, Commander Data's personality is going to be destroyed. And Commander Data then claims he doesn't want to be destroyed and that he has human rights, even though he's a machine. And then there's a court of law where the judges have to decide whether or not Commander Data should be destroyed or not. And actually, this is already, there is real discussion going on now about whether machines that appear to be responsive and sentient, whether they should be given human rights, quotes, whether they should be protected from harm. And there are certainly people around arguing that we should give machines the benefit of the doubt and that if it's possible that they could be in some way suffering or have awareness of what's going on, then we should treat them as moral agents and protect them from harm. There's a film called Her, where the hero of the film falls in love with his operating system. And there's a brand new operating system that is this wonderful female who is only just a voice, voiced by Scarlett Johansson. And again, very fascinating to see the relationship that develops. He just has this little earbud in his ear, and she talks to him, and she's always there, and there's this sort of very intimate relationship. And as chatbots are improving in their sophistication and so on, I don't think this is too far away for where the possibility of having a kind of virtual relationship with this thing, which is always present and a companion. Another important film, Ex Machina, 2015. Again, this is a very humanoid robot who is created and who seems in many ways to be a victim of being abused by the computer technologist but spoiler alert, then the final twist, it turns out that actually she is the one who is manipulating everyone else. And again, it's a common theme, this kind of dystopic theme, that once the machines are created, although we think that those machines are our servants, actually it's all going to end in tears and eventually the machines are going to take over. The show Humans on Channel 4 been pretty influential and again raises a lot of the ethical questions about relationships between humans and humanoid robots and how robots should be treated if they're in our homes. And the writers of the script sort of went out of their way to address a whole series of ethical questions. I think they did it very well, and I recommend the series if you want to watch it. And one of the most recent series is Westworld. This is on American television, but it's available here. And Westworld is based on a novel of some decades ago, but the idea is that there's a robot theme park which has been created somewhere in the Wild West, and human beings can go to this robot theme park and live out their fantasies. And surprise, surprise, it turns out that the fantasies of human beings are all about either slaughtering robots or having sex with them. I mean, what else would you possibly have any fantasies about? But so it's a fairly tacky, adult themes, discretion advised, if you want to go and watch it. But nonetheless, it does raise again a lot of the questions about how we should treat beings that simulate humanity. At the moment, this is all science fiction, but it's coming closer. And I suspect it's not that far away before very real ethical questions are going to be raised. So coming back into the real world, out of the world of science fiction, one of the important concepts, I think, to try and get your head around is called Moore's Law. Moore is a software engineer who was one of the founders of Intel, the big American computer company. And he noticed that the number of transistors that you could put on an integrated circuit was doubling approximately every 2 years. And he first noticed this back in the 1970s, and he wrote a paper just pointing this out. And the fascinating thing is that that process of doubling, which effectively means the doubling of computer power, has carried on every 2 years ever since 1975. And so this is a logarithmic scale. If you look on the vertical axis, you can see that each time you go up a unit, you're going up tenfold. So you start with 1,000 transistors and you end up with 10 billion transistors. And starting in 1970 and going all the way to 2015. And because it's a logarithmic scale, in fact, in reality, if you just did it on a normal axis, you would see this exponential takeoff as the computer power is growing. And it's that phenomenon which is why the computers that we have now, the sort of power that you have in a smartphone, is thousands of times greater than even the most powerful, sophisticated computers that were available just 20 or 30 years ago. There's been an extraordinary runaway phenomenon of this computer power which we're all carrying around about. So something which would have been completely impossible 10 years ago becomes just about possible after 10 years, and after another 10 years is absolutely routine and trivial. And because that process still appears to be going on, as people project on into the future, the capability of the computers that are available is likely just to continue to increase. Now, there's a lot of debate as to how long Moore's Law will continue, and some people think it may be leveling off. But there are other technologies coming along which probably means that, in fact, computer power will continue to increase in this exponential power as we look towards the future. Another thing as you look towards the future is just to see how much money is being invested in this. And this is a recent report suggesting the sort of billions of dollars which are now pouring into artificial intelligence. It's now becoming clear that there are really only going to be two artificial intelligence superpowers in the future, and one of them is going to be the USA, and the other one is going to be China. And there's going to be the most extraordinary competition between these two superpowers as to who is going to achieve dominance. But there are a whole number of reasons to think that actually in the future it's quite likely that China will become the dominant AI superpower for a whole number of reasons, that they're likely to leapfrog the USA in the future. And of course, as we know, China is ruled by a very powerful totalitarian government, and they're going to use AI in order to control the population and to control their influence across the world. And so there are reasons to be really quite concerned about who is in control of this very powerful technology. If you look at robotics, again, this graph is looking at the rise in spending in different categories of robotics. And the four categories of robotic spending are military, industrial, commercial, and personal robots. So there are already vast spending on robotics, but a lot of the robots that are being developed we wouldn't recognize as robots. They're things like the robots that are in manufacturing cars, robots in warehouses, But personal robots and companion robots are likely to grow dramatically over the next few years. So what's going to be the implication of all this advancing technology? Well, one whole question is, what's it going to do for employment? And I quite like this quote, which says, "The workers of the future will be divided into two categories, those who are good at working with intelligent machines and those who are replaced by intelligent machines." That's basically the only option you have. You either get good at working with machines or you will be replaced. And the optimists say, well, if we look into history, we can see that whenever new technologies come along, it has displaced a lot of workers, it's led to a lot of unemployment, but at the same time, it's created a whole lot of new jobs, even jobs that we couldn't imagine. And so actually, that same is going to happen in the future. Yes, a lot of people are going to end up unemployed, a lot of people are going to find their jobs are destroyed, but at the same time, there's going to be a whole wave of new jobs. Now, precisely how many jobs are going to be destroyed, again, is controversial and debated, but there's not much doubt that a very significant number of jobs are going to be replaced by this advancing technology. And one of the really disturbing things to me is that although the impact in places like the UK is going to be very significant, the greatest impact is going to be in the developing countries, probably, because so many jobs in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and in other poor parts of the world are jobs which could potentially be replaced by automation. For instance, a huge amount of agriculture, which is a very important part of the economy in many low-resource countries, can potentially be replaced by agricultural robots. And so the question is how we will deal with the vast social disruption that's going to take place. And it's interesting that some of the leaders in Silicon Valley, people like Elon Musk and Zuckerberg and others, who are forward-looking, they are the people who are pushing for what's now called a universal basic income, because they can see that there's going to be so much social disruption. They're arguing that the government should be giving everybody, all the citizens, a standard amount. Now, I think I've asked the question, well, what can they see that the rest of us can't? And I suspect that, you know, they may well be right. They know their technology and they're predicting the disruptive power of their technology. I think they're genuinely afraid of social unrest. They're afraid that there could be riots in the streets if it becomes apparent quite how much jobs are being laid waste to. And so to try and prevent that kind of thing, they think the best thing to do is to keep the proletariat quiet by giving them all a sort of a basic income. So meanwhile, we can stay on carrying our increasing profits and our vast wealth can continue to accumulate. So I think there are some real questions about employment. It may be that that's overly negative. I do think there's going to be vast disruption. And therefore, I think just from a Christian point of view, and those of us who are connected with Christian churches, I think one issue is a pastoral issue. How are we going to cope with people who suddenly find themselves put out of job by machines and who have no real prospect about retraining? The government, the standard line is, oh yes, well, everybody just has to retrain. But the idea that a sort of a truck driver age 55 who finds himself unemployed because of autonomous trucks is somehow going to retrain as a web designer, I think is just unrealistic. And so how are we as a church going to support and cope with people who find themselves suddenly displaced and with no possibility of getting a job? In the field of healthcare, again, this is being targeted by many commercial companies as a prime area for artificial intelligence. And that's because of the huge profits that are potentially can be made in healthcare, as well as the fact that it seems quite suitable for using this modern technique, which is called machine learning, which is basically using sophisticated technology in order to recognize patterns in very large data sets. And so IBM Watson have invested more than $1 billion in creating this system called Watson, which is designed to be able to take in vast data sets and then use various kinds of analysis, including machine learning, to make diagnoses. So you can load the entire patient's records, all the medical notes, all the laboratory results, the DNA results. And Watson happens to contain the entire world literature in science and medicine, which is constantly being updated on a daily basis. And then Watson takes all of this stuff and then comes out with a diagnosis or a series of diagnoses rated in probabilities, and then treatment options, again, rated in probabilities and so on. And a system has been trained with cancer specialists, oncologists in New York, and IBM claim that it's possible to take this system, which has been working with cancer specialists in New York, and give the system to a junior doctor working in the Philippines, and you can show that that junior doctor is able to work at the same kind of diagnostic level as the specialists in New York. So in a positive sense, you can see that this is going to have an amazing democratization of knowledge. It's going to be possible for the sort of very sophisticated expertise, which used to be only available in a very small number of highly trained professionals, can potentially become available across the world. It's the sort of thing that you can have on a smartphone. And in fact, the smartphone is going to become an absolutely essential part of healthcare, but particularly for people in developing countries, because through the smartphone, it will be possible to get expert advice, analysis, diagnostic and therapeutic advice, and so on. One of the worrying facts, though, of course, is that IBM is not a charity. IBM is a commercial company, and it's looking for a commercial return on the $1 billion of investment. And so, at the moment, they seem to be using Watson as a loss leader. They're making it available for hospitals across the world virtually free. But you can imagine what's going to happen in the future, that once the hospitals and the patients, everyone becomes dependent on the system, IBM will then have this amazing monopoly to be able to start increasing the power. So there are real worries about, although positively this technology is going to lead undoubtedly to all kinds of positive things in healthcare, it raises questions about who controls the technology and how are they going to use it. Another company called Google DeepMind, it was initially called DeepMind, bought up by Google, they are specialists in machine learning, and they decided to create a computer program to play the Chinese game of Go. The reason they chose Go is that Go is a much more complex game compared with chess. And in fact, the number of possible moves in Go are apparently greater than the number of molecules in the visible universe. And therefore, it's completely impossible to work out by calculation what the best moves are in Go. And there are people in China and elsewhere who are professional Go players, and they spend years studying the game. And they learn by intuition and feel to work out what the best moves are and so on. Well, DeepMind produced a program called AlphaGo. And the mind-boggling thing is how they did it. What they did is they taught the program the basic rules of Go, and they downloaded several thousand published games of Go and put this into the machine so they could teach it the basic principles. But then what they did is they developed two versions of the same program, and they left these two versions of the program playing each other in the computer system. And apparently they left it playing, the computers played millions of games playing against each other and constantly learning in the process and improving their skills. And eventually, after they played millions of games, which it only took a few months, they then brought the program out and they pitched it against a world-leading player who was called Lee Sedol, playing this game. And lo and behold, AlphaGo won hands down and beat one of the best players in the world. And what's more, some of the moves it made, one or two of the moves it made, apparently were completely unexpected. And people who were experts in Go said, oh, that was such a beautiful move and so unexpected. And no human being would have made that move. But now we've seen the move, we can understand how brilliant it was and how beautifully executed and so on. So now the what the really important point about this is that AlphaGo was not programmed by experts in the game. And so you sometimes hear people say, well, a computer can only do what it's programmed to do. And I'm afraid that is just wrong. These computers have gone beyond that stage in that they are genuinely able to learn new knowledge within a very restricted field and can therefore function at a far greater ability than humans. Now, it has to be said that that these kind of programs are often what's called narrow AI. They can only work in a very narrow place. And you would only have to make a very slight change and the whole thing falls over. So they're often called very brittle systems. For instance, AlphaGo is played on a grid of 19 by 19, apparently. And somebody pointed out that if you were to change it and make it 19 by 20, the machine would be completely flummoxed and would just bomb out. It couldn't cope at all. So these systems, the narrow AI, will only operate in a very specific place where it's been operated. And of course, that's completely different from human intelligence. The way we as humans, the extraordinary thing about humans is our adaptability, our ability to cope with completely unexpected things and to make rough guidance and judgments about and so on. But nonetheless, in these specific areas, there's no doubt that these artificial intelligence techniques are going to become more and more powerful. In Google DeepMind, they use AlphaGo really for publicity and as to demonstrate the power of the technique. What they're interested in, again, is in health. And they've been using the same kind of machine learning system for looking at retinal scans at the back of the eye. And they've already shown that they're able to pick up abnormalities in the retina as good as well as highly trained ophthalmologists. And probably in the future, all medical imaging, all kinds of scans are going to be basically analyzed by machines. And the human radiologists and so on will work with the machines, but the machines will be primarily doing most of the hard work. So there's no doubt that it's this kind of systems are really going to have an impact in healthcare, and positively they will probably lead to improvements in the speed in which investigations can be analyzed, in the way that diagnoses can be obtained and so on, and hopefully reduce the number of medical mistakes. The idea of robotic companions is now having a high profile. So people are looking into the future and saying there's so many old people in our society. And as we look to the future, there are going to be more and more. There just aren't enough human beings to be carers. So surely what we've got to do is create some robotic companions. Now, I don't know about you, but if I was sort of feeling old and confused and I was to wake up and this thing was there offering me biscuits, I think I'd be even feeling even older and even more confused. But this is a very big business. Particularly, it's the place that's leading the world here is Japan. Japan has the largest number of old people relative to young people in the world. And the government has been investing in robotic technology for the last 20 years in creating specialized companion robots. I think one of the rather sad things that's going on is that if you think about the caring of an older person, the job of caring, you can basically divide it into two. On the one hand, there is the back-breaking physical stuff of caring for an older person. For instance, so the lifting, the cleaning, the bed changing, the going to the toilet, all that kind of stuff. And then on the other hand, there is the actual companionship of being a friend and talking and giving them meaning and purpose in their life. Now, in an ideal world, what you would say is that what the machines should do, number one, all the backbreaking physical stuff, and then the human beings can do the companionship. Sadly, what's happening is exactly the opposite. In other words, a huge amount of investment is going on to make robotic companions who will basically talk to and be fun for old people, whereas the backbreaking stuff is going to be left to be done by the humans. And the reason for that seems to be largely technical, and that is it's much easier to make a little box that chirps away and chats to you than it is to devise all the business of machines that can lift and carry and change beds and all the rest, which is incredibly complex and painful. So this is one of those robotic paradoxes that the things which to us seem very basic are the hardest things for robots to do, whereas the things which to us seem very sophisticated, like beating chess champions and so on, machines can do very easily. Another area is in the area of autonomous weapons. And again, this is a fairly scary area because the whole idea is to try and take the human soldier out of the loop. So instead of expecting a human soldier to recognize that the enemy is there and then make a decision to fire, you can create an autonomous weapon which would use machine learning and artificial intelligence to recognize that this is an enemy, and as soon as it recognizes it, it presses the button and fires. And part of the argument is why we have to have autonomous weapons is that if the enemies have autonomous weapons, then we can't respond fast enough. If the enemy is able to respond within microseconds, it's no use expecting the human being to be able to make a decision. And the second reason for having autonomous weapons, it is claimed, is that actually human beings, soldiers often do terrible things. And therefore, the autonomous weapons are less likely to get drunk. They're less likely to undergo sort of racial cleansing and do terrible things. And the autonomous weapons can be programmed with the Geneva Convention, and et cetera, et cetera. But having said that, there are other people who think this is really a step too far. Once we're moving to these automated weapon systems where there's no appeal to a human being who has a conscience and who can be held accountable in a court of law, then we're really taking a step too far. So that I think this question about autonomous weapons, incidentally, the UK is one of the few countries that hasn't signed up to a ban of autonomous weapons. And so this is a very live issue, I think, actually, in the UK military. So as we look to the future, there doesn't appear to be any limit to the potential processing power of intelligent machines. And this is something, again, which is causing a lot of concern. So when you think about anything else in physics or in biology or in engineering, there are always some kind of limits because of the laws of physics and the laws of the natural world. But once you're coming to ones and noughts, to computer processing, then there doesn't appear to be any limit as to how powerful a computer system can become. And this is raising all kinds of questions. So this is taken from a book by an Oxford philosopher called Superintelligence. So along this... Along this axis... Oh, no, I have really done it. See, the technology. Come back! Yes, quite. Nothing can go wrong. Oh, dear. Whoa, dear. Talk among yourselves. Sorry. Yes. Well, the great thing about machines is how well they work. Okay. I think we're nearly there. I think it's really gone off on its own. We've got the important signs of clinical depression, which I'm about to get. I think we're going. Right, here we go. Yeah. So, as you go along the horizontal axis, this is intelligence. So that's the intelligence of a mouse. That's the intelligence of a chimpanzee. That's the intelligence of a village idiot. And that's the intelligence of Einstein. So the entire sum of human intelligence is between these two. The range of human intelligence is between those two things. Okay. So what happens when a machine turns out whose intelligence is out here? Which is the intelligence is as much above Einstein as the Einstein is above mouse. Do we think that this machine out here is going to be particularly interested in human beings? Do you think it's going to be interested in protecting the interests of human beings? Or is it going to treat us much like the way we treat mice? In fact, semi-seriously, I've heard somebody say that if the world is taken over by some super-intelligent computer, the only prospect for the survival of humanity is we've got to persuade it that we're cute. I mean, you don't need to destroy us. We're quite nice. We're no threats. We're cuddly. So, So, there are people really worried about the possibility of some kind of superintelligent computer that would treat us with contempt. And, for instance, Stephen Hawking is one of the people who came out and said artificial intelligence could end mankind. Elon Musk is another. A number of quite well-known commentators have talked about this. And it's interesting, and this is where you come into some philosophy, if you are a physicalist, and a physicalist or a materialist is somebody who believes that there is nothing in the universe except for matter and energy. Physics is all there is. If you believe that, and very many, in fact the majority of scientists working in across the world are physicalists. That's what they would say. There is nothing but matter and energy. If you believe that, then you have to say that everything that's going on in the human brain is simply a question of connections. It's simply wiring and cells and so on. And therefore, everything that's come out of the human brain, and that is all the most beautiful and wonderful things that have come out from the human brain, but also the most evil and terrible things that have come out of the human brain, everything is simply a prospect of wiring. It's simply because of the wiring in our brains. If that is true, and that's what a physicalist would have to say, then you have to say the same thing could happen in a computer. And therefore, there's no reason to think that if we were creating a very sophisticated computer, there's no reason to think that only good things would come out of it. What if we created a Hitler, or a Stalin, or an ISIS? And what also we know from history is that some of the most evil people don't go around with a label that says, by the way, I am very evil. In fact, they may come across as extremely pleasant and will not demonstrate what they're genuinely concerned about. And in exactly the same way, how do we know that the computer isn't going to be the same? That the computer is going to tell us that it's friendly and there's nothing to be concerned about, but actually could have something far more evil. Now, at the moment, that's all science fiction, but it's interesting seeing how the philosophy leads you there. If you're a physicalist, then you have to be worried. You have to say this is a possibility. On a positive side, people are saying, there are some people arguing that actually, as we look on into the future, it's pretty obvious that Homo sapiens is doomed. That people like us are never going to survive on into the future. What is going to survive are the machines. So Martin Rees is a well-known astronomer royal. He said, abstract thinking by biological brains has underpinned the emergence of all culture and science. But this activity, spanning tens of millennia at most, will be a brief precursor to the more powerful intellects of the inorganic post-human era. And so it's interesting that there's a new grand narrative which is now emerging. You're probably all familiar with the left-hand part of this picture, the idea that human beings evolve by random forces over millions of years and slowly life progresses to the point when eventually you get to Homo sapiens as the highest form of life. But now there are more and more people saying perhaps Homo sapiens is just a stage in the evolution of life. And what's going to happen is they're going to be machines which will go on into the future. And that Homo sapiens is merely a transitional stage. And some people are saying these are our mind children. Our real organic children, our meat children, they are never going to be able to cope with the universe and with all the problems of the future. What's going to happen in the future is it's our mind children, the machines we make, and they're going to spread out across the solar system and then across the universe. And long after Homo sapiens has died, or been exterminated or blown itself up, the machines are the ones that are going to go on into the future. And some people are arguing that compared with the limitations and fallibilities of human intelligence, perhaps machine intelligence is much better. It's more desirable. It's better suited to the world. So to step back a bit, I can see a sort of two-way psychological movement between the machine on the one hand and the human on the other. So on the one hand, there's a movement from the machine to the human. In other words, we think of ourselves as being like machines. We imagine ourselves as being like computers, like an artificial intelligence. And it's quite interesting how we use phrases like he's hardwired or she's programmed, or I need to reboot my memory systems, or those kind of languages actually, or as a physicist said, life is a self-replicating information processing system. So this is that kind of mechanized thinking. And I suggest you should be alert to that. Notice the way that machine thinking is coming more and more into our culture. And it's important to understand that there's a philosophical fallacy behind all this. And it's that there is a crucial difference between a metaphor and a fundamental description. So it's quite true to say that there are many aspects of the human brain which are like a machine. The machine is a metaphor, and the brain is something like a machine. But it's false and incoherent to say that the brain is a machine. And that distinction is something which is constantly lost. You hear people saying, oh, well, we're just machines, and, oh, you know, we're like... It's a metaphor. It's not a description. So that's the movement that way. But then there's the movement the other way. That is, we put our humanity onto the machine. And that's, well, anthropomorphism. It's a long word, I'm afraid. But anthropomorphism just means anthropo, human, morphe, form. What we do is we see a human form on a non-human being. And the machines... The people who are making robots are very well aware of the fact that we have this human tendency to regard something that seems cute and friendly and is moving, to regard this as a human being. So just, this is a little thing called a Nio robot. It's about 18 inches tall and it moves around, its eyes blink, its arms wave around, it speaks. And as you can see, people enjoy... engaging with it. I was at a conference in Durham about 18 months ago, and it was with a whole group of senior Christian leaders and other people, and we were all discussing some of this theological and deep philosophical issues about technology. As part of the conference, we visited a computer lab in the university, and this group of about 40 senior church leaders walk into the computer lab, and on the floor are five of these little Nio robots. And they're all switched on, and their lights are blinking, and they're speaking, and their arms are moving like this. And all of a sudden, the atmosphere in the room changes. And a bishop gets down on his hands and knees and says, oh, hello, look at the little darling. Hello, how are you? And everybody's waving and smiling. And I'm watching all this and thinking, what hope is there? You know, if this is how the church leadership respond... Is there any hope for the rest of us? But as I was reflecting about it afterwards, I was thinking that actually most of those people in that room would be parents, and they had looked after young children. And one of the things you know as a parent is that if you're just come across this little 18-month-old toddler who's toddling along the floor, you don't just walk by and ignore them. You sort of engage them, and you say, oh, hello, how are you? And... Are you lost? And where's your mummy and daddy? And, you know, that's just a sort of imprinted, isn't it, into what it means to be a parent. And I think that's why people, that's how they were responding to these robots. But, of course, the manufacturers know that, and they're doing it deliberately. They want us to engage with these machines. They want us to treat them as though they were human beings. And so we're going to see a whole epidemic, I guarantee, in the next few years. We're going to see an epidemic of cute, cuddly robots who are going to want to come into our homes and be available for us. This one is called Jibo. It just has a sort of single eye, but it's very cute and it wobbles around. But it's just interesting to see, again, the wording. He loves to be around people, and the relationships he forms are the single most important thing to him. And one of the strange things is that if you take a human being and you put them in a brain scanner, it's the sort of thing that psychologists do, and you then take a sort of humanoid robot and you do unpleasant things to the robot, like you appear to torture the robot, you can show that the human being will respond in the same way as though you were torturing a human being. So the same brain centers will be activated, And they've done experiments where they've asked people to torture robots, and you get all kinds of responses where people say, I can't do that. And, you know, especially when the robot is pleading for mercy and is crying. And yet there are other people who actually rather can act out fantasies of sadomasochistic rape, of abuse, of torture, and so on, and actually seem to get some kind of buzz from torturing robots. And I think this is going to become a major ethical question for our society. Should there be laws which restrict what you can do with a humanoid robot? And I think the question is not, are we damaging the robot? The question is, are we damaging ourselves if we allow people to do this? It's particularly an issue when it comes to sex robots. And already, there, for instance, you can get sex robots of all kinds of things, and you can get child sex robots. And the arguments go that maybe it's, you know, if somebody has a tendency towards paedophilia, that it's better to give them a child sex robot, that they're not going to harm anybody. But then you ask the question, is this the kind of society we want to live in, where people are living out fantasies? It's very interesting, you know, that in the UK, if you were to deliberately torture or harm a kitten, you're guilty of a very serious criminal offence and you can go to prison for many years. Is this because we as a society feel so strongly about the rights of kittens? Or is it more that we feel that actually if somebody's torturing a kitten, they're doing something to themselves, it's saying something about them, and we want to express as a society the kind of people we want to live in our society and use laws to restrict it. So anthropomorphism is a universal human tendency which is largely outside of conscious control. You can't decide whether you're going to anthropomorphize. It just happens instantaneously. It's part of our humanity and it has lots of positive things, but it opens us up to manipulation and deception. And I was very struck by these words from a American journalist who says, human compassion can be gamed. It is the ultimate psychological hack, a glitch in human response that can be exploited in an attempt to make a sticky product. That's why designers give AIs human characteristics in the first place. They want us to like them. So I wonder whether there will have to be laws, as I've said, not only which protect humanoid robots, I also wonder whether there should be laws so that if anything is pretending to be human, by law, they should have to tell us, actually, I'm not human. I'm not a human person. And maybe just like there are laws which have to protect us before we buy insurance and laws that, that tell us about data protection and all the rest, maybe they're going to have to be laws that try to prevent the harm that will come from apparently developing relationships with these beings. So as we look to the future, I think we're going to have a whole sort of epidemic of physical robots, many of them cute and cuddly, some of them like this. We're also going to see avatars. This is a therapist system called Ellie, and it's just a picture of this woman on a screen. But as you can see up at the top, there's also a camera and very sophisticated technology which is monitoring the client, the human client. And Ellie counsels the person and is monitoring their behavior and their eye movements and their body posture and facial movements and so on. And in real time, Ellie is responding. You can go onto YouTube and see the video. It's quite scary because you can see the power of the system. But people are arguing this means that we're going to be able to have therapy in lots of different ways, maybe through a smartphone. And we're also going to have simulated persons just as voices. This is Google Home, you know, about Alexa. Again, there's probably going to be many more systems. Wherever we go, we're going to find voices that talk to us and engage with us and behave in this sort of friendly sort of way. There's a system now which provides counseling for people with depression. And there's an app which is rather nicely called a Woebot, W-O-E-B-O-T. I'm ready to learn 24/7. You can have a virtual existence in the cloud. So if you upload into some of these systems every single email you've ever sent and every single text, you can live forever in the cloud. After you've died, this system will continue to send emails and texts and social media posts to your friends and loved ones. And believe it or not, this was on the BBC website. I talk to my dead friend via the app, and the dead friend speaks back through this program. And people are saying this is a wonderful way of keeping the relationship and so on. So this blurring between what is real and what is simulated is something that's going to happen increasingly. And I was very struck by an episode in Westworld. A new human being has just arrived in this robotic theme park, and this beautiful woman comes up to him and basically says, "Is there anything I can do for you?" And he stares at her and he says, "Are you real?" And she says, "If you can't tell, does it matter?" And I think that is a very profound question which we're going to have to address. Does it matter if this relationship is authentic and real, or if it's simulated? And I think as Christians, most of us would say, yes, it does matter. There's something about the authenticity of genuine relationships which is important. But we're going to have to ask the question, why? Why does it matter? And in a world that is increasingly occupied by intelligent machines, what are human beings for? If the machines are better and better at doing the things which we used to think were exclusively human, then what are human beings for? Well, in the last 10 minutes, I just want to focus on some Christian responses. We'll stop, and then there'll be chance for discussion and so on. And I want to go all the way back to the 4th century AD, and church fathers, particularly in the eastern part of the empire, who were trying to formulate an understanding about the Holy Trinity, of what the relationship between God the Father and God the Son and God the Spirit. And they came up with this Greek phrase that God's being is hypostasis in ekstasis. They took a Greek word, hypostasis, which just meant stuff or substance, but they changed the meaning of that word, and the word means person. And they said God's being is three persons in ekstasis. And ekstasis means outgoing. What it means is the Father is giving himself to the Son. The Son is giving himself to the Father. The Father is giving himself to the Spirit. The Spirit is giving himself to the Father. There are three persons in relationship, in giving themselves to one another. And so from this way of thinking about persons, to be a person is a category of reality, to use a philosophical term, which is ontologically foundational. That means that you can't define being a person in any more basic thing. To be a person is the lowest level you can get. And persons are not reducible to matter and energy. Yes, you and I, our bodies are made of matter and energy, but there's something else about you and something else about me. And that is our personhood, that you're a person and I'm a person. And persons are, this is what the church fathers said, persons are constituted by their relations. So what the church fathers said is that actually the Father cannot be Father unless the Son exists. So the being of the Father depends on the being of the Son. And the Son cannot be Son unless the Father exists. The being of the Son depends on the existence of the Father. So the persons are constituted by their relations. Their being is derived from the movement of union and communion, the freedom to give oneself to the other in self-giving love. And so what then, if this way of thinking, we are persons, but we are persons, if you like, we're sub-persons. Because we're made in God's image, we as human persons reflect the persons of the Trinity. And actually, therefore, to be a person is to participate in some sense in the divine life of the triune God. The very fact that you're a person means that whether you like it or not, you are involved with God and he is involved with you. He knows you, he loves you, he is calling you to himself. That's what basic Christian theology says. So we all know what Descartes says, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. The trouble with that definition is it's totally individualistic. It's all about me, my thoughts, my consciousness, therefore I am. But a Christian approach, a Trinitarian approach, would be to say, no, no, that's wrong. You love me, therefore I am. Our being is in relation, and it's because I am loved that I exist. Another way of thinking about that is the difference between an I-you relationship and an I-it relationship. The Jewish philosopher Martin Buber wrote a famous book called I and Thou, or I and You. And it's still worth reading if you're interested in this area. And what he was arguing is that the I-you relationship is fundamentally different from the I-it relationship. And in fact, we start with an IU relationship. All of us, as children, the first relationships we have are not with things and with the rest of the world. The first relationship we have is with people, with our mother, and with human beings. And so I think the real challenge, this difference is really important. But what is happening is these machines, which are only its, increasingly will feel like a you. There will be a sort of blurring between the I-it relationship and the I-you relationship. So if we go back to this graph and we put on the personhood dimension, we see that actually it's quite different from the intelligence dimension. What you would say is that the mouse isn't a person. The chimpanzee is, well, a partial person, but it's not a full person. But both the village idiot and Einstein are equally persons. If you think about it, you think about the most intelligent person you've ever met, and you think about one of the stupidest people you've ever met, they're both equally people. Einstein isn't more of a person than... So personhood is something completely different from intelligence. And even if we had a machine out here on the intelligence dimension, it wouldn't be a person. So processing power is not the same as personhood, and we need to cling to that distinction because it's a very important distinction. Now, one of the specifically Christian things, which again comes from the early church fathers, is, and it comes from the Nicene Creed, which is in the AD 325, the church fathers, taking the wording from the Bible, the New Testament, they said that Jesus was begotten, in Old English, not made, born, not made. And what they meant, they wanted to draw a distinction between that which we give birth to and that which we create with our hands. Because that which we give birth to, our children, is fundamentally the same as us. Our children come as a gift from our being, and they're equal to us in status and dignity. And we care for, nurture, and educate our children, but we cannot control them or determine their nature. Every parent discovers that however much you would wish to, you cannot control your children. But what's more, you can't say what they are for. Our children are human beings who have the gift. They've been given the gift of being human. And however much you would wish them to do X, Y, and Z, they're going to do what they want to do. They are persons. They're equal to us. Now compare that with the things we make. That which we make or create is fundamentally different from us. It comes of a product of our will and is ours to mold and control. And so we can determine what it is for and what it will do. So that's the distinction between the machine and the person. The machine that we make, however clever, however sophisticated, however good at simulating being a person, it is not the same as the beings who come from our body, as the children who are the gift that God gives to us. And so that's the distinction between being born or being made, which I think is really important. And then finally, the historic Christian faith makes the claim that Jesus was raised from the dead. But he wasn't raised from the dead as a completely unrecognizable new kind of being. No, the extraordinary thing about the risen Jesus was that he was a recognizable, touchable human being. And what some theologians have said is that in the resurrection of Jesus, God has said the final yes to the original model human beings. he's said that this kind of humanity is fit to be transformed and renewed and to enter the new heaven and the new earth. So the future of humanity is not, according to the Christian faith, in increasingly sophisticated machines and enhanced human beings who are completely going to divert from our humanity. No, the future of the human race is through death and resurrection. And that God has said the final yes to this kind of humanity. So to close, AI and robotic technologies are going to have a profound impact on many aspects of society, particularly in employment, social and healthcare, human relationships, leisure activities, and I'm afraid, warfare. How are we going to respond? And this is particularly for people who are Christians. I would suggest here just some pointers. The first is what Jesus said, watch and pray. You remember how he criticized the disciples because he said, you know how to interpret the weather signs, but you don't know how to interpret what's happening around you, the signs of the times. And so I would call that critical vigilance. We need to be watching what is happening, and we need to be praying for wisdom as we confront these new technological challenges. Secondly, I think we need to remember, don't be afraid. Whenever God appears in the Bible, almost every time the first words are, fear not, don't be afraid. And it's possible to look at all these developments and think, good heavens, what is going to happen to our society? What's going to happen to our children? And we need to remember, don't be afraid. We can be confident that God's sovereign purposes are being worked out in the unfolding of history, and we're called to play our tiny part in the great drama. And maybe artificial intelligence and robotics is going to turn out to have some part to play in the great drama of what God is doing in our midst. And then thirdly, the mysterious parable of the wheat and the weeds. I think that's one of the most profound and mysterious of Jesus' parables. Because in the parable, if you remember, the wheat and the weeds are growing together, inextricably linked together in the field, which is the picture of the world. And the friends of the harvest owner say, shall we separate them into different, put the wheats over there and the weeds over there? And the Lord of the harvest says, no, let them grow together. They will be separated at the end of the age. But in some mysterious purposes, in God's purposes, his plan is that the good and evil should be growing inextricably intertwined. And I think you can see that in many fields, but I think you can see it in artificial intelligence, that you can see good and wonderful things happening and you see absolutely terrible things happening and they are inextricably intertwined. We need to celebrate original model humanity and unenhanced human nature and behavior, because this is the form in which God became flesh. I do wonder whether, you know, just like there's a campaign for real ale and things like that, in the future we're going to have a campaign for real humanity. And we're going to have to say, you know what, we could enter into virtual reality, we could have all these artificial relationships, but actually we want to defend old-fashioned human relationships. Face-to-face, no technology, sharing friendship, having a meal together, worshipping together, these things matter because it's the way we're made. And we need to reflect on the significance of the physical resurrection of Jesus, God's final vote of confidence in human nature. Orthodox Christian theology highlights the distinction between beings who are born and those who are made, and this distinction may become increasingly important as we're surrounded by machines that simulate human behavior, relationality, personhood. And just finally, the UK has the possibility of playing an influential role in the global AI and robotics world. So one of the interesting things I've found is that it's pretty clear that the American government is not going to seriously regulate what's happening in Silicon Valley because they don't want to kill the goose that's laying the golden egg. And it's also pretty clear that the Chinese government is not going to regulate AI and robotics because they see it as an enormously powerful means of maintaining control. So where is advances in regulation going to come from? Answer, it's going to come from Europe. And in Europe, UK is leading the field. When it comes to think tanks and people working on the ethics of robotics and all that, it's actually the UK which is at the head of the field. So we happen to be in the best country in the world for being able to exercise an influence on the development and particularly innovative approaches to regulation. So if you're thinking about a field to go into, or you're already in the field of engineering and science or technology, then maybe getting involved in the ethics of technology and regulation and so on would be a particular way of exercising an influence. And I finally just want to pay tribute to the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion, who's been supporting a research project I've been part of in this area, and the Templeton Foundation, who provided the funding. Thanks so much.
I am not a robot. Thank you, John, very much. My head is spinning. I guess yours must be as well. Time for a break. I was just thinking, you know, the number of times at Christmas we sing that carol, God of God, light of light, lo, he abhors not the virgin's womb. Very God, begotten, not created. You'll sing that differently this year, won't you? You'll think about it. It's so important. There's a bookstall, refreshments, questions. Avail yourselves of everything that's at the back there, and in about 20, 25 minutes, we'll come back and just have a few question and answers. Thank you so much, John.